Okay, we're going to start to talk about how God is described, pictured, what we can know about God. The first idea which everybody is aware of, I think, is that God is literally beyond all possible description. All possible conception. All possible understanding. Now, as I've mentioned to some of you a number of times, so I have to just understand to talk about this a little bit and what are all the scriptures doing. But let's start with that idea itself. Why is that? Why is it that God is beyond all possible description, beyond all possible understanding? How do we know that? Where does it come from? Must it be that way? One source for the idea in the tradition is God being one. This is how Maimonides in the Guide does it. Actually, others agree as well. We think God is one, says Maimonides, we mean absolutely one. One in every respect, in every dimension, in every consideration. After all, we really do have to say something, because in simple terms, everything is one. It's one, whatever it is. Moby Dick is one novel. Beethoven's Fifth Symphony is one symphony. You are one person. This table is one table. So, you say God is one, if you don't mean any more than that, then God is no different from anything else. God is one of what he is. Of course, so is anything else one of what it is. If saying God is one is supposed to say something special about God, something that isn't true about everything else, it's got to mean something different from what it means for everything else. So one way of explaining it, it's Maimonides' way of explaining it, that he's one and only one. All the other examples I gave you are one in a certain respect, but in other respects they are many. Moby Dick is one novel, but it has 347 pages. So it's not one in the respect of the number of pages it has. And it weighs, you know, a pound and a half. So it's not one in the respect of its weight, and its volume, and its composition, and its price. And so there are lots of respects in which Moby Dick isn't one. You're one, but you have lots of parts, lots of ideas, and you have a height and a weight and a density, and so you're one in the sense of being one person. But there are lots of other respects in which you aren't one. God is one in every respect. Whatever you want to say about him, whatever way you want to think about him or relate to him, the only number that comes up is one. That's the way Maimonides puts it. Now, that's a very radical idea. And it has all sorts of important consequences. First of all, for almost everything, that will mean that God is not a physical object. Why? Because physical objects have parts. And usually, there's more than one part. For all the physical objects with which we're familiar, they have all the parts. Okay, so then you have elementary particles. Okay. But even an elementary particle, like, for example, a photon or an electron, which are not made of quarks, so far as we know today, they don't have smaller parts. They might be strings, but a string also is one thing. But they could have different aspects, and it's not made up of different you know, other things that they're composed out of. But for example, if the particle is spinning, as some of them do, then you have the pole spinning clockwise and the pole spinning counterclockwise, depending on where you're looking from. So it has two poles. Indeed, if it's spinning, then there are two points on the surface that aren't spinning. The two points put to the poles of the spin. So you can distinguish those two points from the other points on the surface. Even though it's not made up of parts, but you can distinguish different elements in it. So if God is one and only one, then the only number that ever applies to him is one, he's not a physical object. That Maimonides already says in the Mishneh Torah, which he wrote for everybody. In the guide, he goes further and says, this makes God indescribable and inconceivable. Because the way we describe and the way we conceive is through a complex of terms related to one another. The minute we start talking, we go on and on. We don't just stop with one idea. If I ask, what is God like, and I take the descriptions that are part of the tradition literally, then he's all-knowing and all-powerful and just and merciful. That's already four. We're not stuck at one. We're already at the four. Yes, if you keep asking, you'll get more and more. So, if I take oneness, in my monody sense, it'll come out that he's indescribable and inconceivable. And each of those descriptions goes together with a concept. And we have a whole raft of concepts. And that raft isn't going to do it. Because it's more than one. So that's an explanation of the idea. Based on oneness. The mystical sources just assert flat out, lace Hashavat Yisavei. Thought does not grasp it. The prophets, Isaiah says, Be'el mit demuni yomar kadosh. To whom will you compare me, says the Holy One. Well, descriptions are usually based on comparisons. If you can't compare God to anything, to anyone, what are you going to say? If you say he knows something, you're implicitly comparing him to us, because your concept of knowledge is derived from your experience of human knowledge. If you say he's powerful, you're comparing him to whatever is the source of your idea of power. You can't help it, because the ideas that you have, you get from the physical world. If you use them to describe God, then you're automatically comparing him to something. And Isaiah says, can't be compared to anything. Now, all of these considerations come from the tradition. It's Maimonides' explanation of the oneness of God. It's the Zohar HaKadosh. It's the verse in Isaiah. It's the tradition that's saying that God is beyond conception, beyond description, beyond understanding. Is there any external reason, any philosophical reason, any way that we should be able to figure out on our own that he is beyond conception? Maybe, but here again you're relying backhandedly on the tradition. If you take the idea of God as creator, creator out of nothing. If you understand he created the universe and creates the universe, present tense, out of nothing, we have absolutely no analogy to that. Nothing in our experience is like that. Nowhere do we have a creation, a conscious, deliberate decision to create something out of nothing. So if our fundamental concept of God is the being who performed this action for which we have no model whatsoever, of which we have no understanding whatsoever, maybe it would be reasonable to say the being that could pull that off also is beyond our conception. Because what he's doing, and this is fundamentally the role that he has in our thought system, that he's a creator, this is something that's really totally beyond our experience, totally beyond our conception. Indeed, according to Ramchal, the whole of the Kabbalah is totally silent on creation. It has nothing to say about creation. How it happened, how he did it. It's not a subject that the Jewish tradition deals with. Period. The whole of the Kabbalah, says Ramchal, is describing God's purposes for which he created and how the things that he created are related to his purposes. That's all. But how the creation process takes place is something about which the entire Jewish tradition is silent. And it's silent because it's beyond our ability to understand. Now, I'm stressing this because there have been people in academia who missed it, along with lots of other stuff that they miss, because of superficial similarities between our tradition and certain philosophical systems, and because there was even contact between some rabbis and representatives or students of the representatives of those philosophical traditions, they assumed that our system of ideas had a purpose similar to those philosophical systems. But it's simply not true. On occasion, our sources will use terminology, ideas, structures that are common to educated people in order to express the hidden truths of the mystical side of Judaism, symbolically, by allusion, without any commitment whatsoever to the mode of expressing being true or not. Now, I'm telling you what Ramchal writes here in his essay on the Gattaca, which is translated, Rabbi Feldman translated it in The Traveler and the King, and I recommend it. Rabbi Feldman's book is very good, but in addition, in the back, he has the translation of Ramchal, which is really gold. And my father says this. Very often the rabbis wanted to express, at least in a hint, some Kabbalistic idea. So what they did was they took an analogy from contemporary science or contemporary pictures of the world and used it to express those ideas without any commitment to the contemporary science being true. So, for example, the ancient world, they thought that the physical world is made up of four elements. Everything that exists is a combination of those four elements. Earth, air, fire, and water. And whether you're talking about a diamond, or you're talking about a worm, whether you're talking about thread, or you're talking about clouds, it's all a combination of earth, air, fire, and water. Well, Chazal also talk in terms of earth, air, fire, and water. But, says Ramchal, when they talk in those terms, their interest is not in discussing the composition of diamonds and threads and worms, but rather forces that underlie the spiritual nature of the world. And because there are four such forces, and because their contemporary world talks about four elements, they use the four elements as symbols for those four forces. But they had no concern whatsoever whether the world, the physical world, was really made up of those four elements or not. So that today, when we don't use that concept anymore of four elements, that says nothing about the validity of what Chazal expressed, because they weren't expressing a hypothesis about what makes up the physical world. By the way, just as a little analogy, some have suggested And earth, air, fire, and water could be used even today to express the four states of matter. Not four elements out of which everything is made, but four states of matter. Earth is solid. Water is liquid. Air is gas. And fire is process. Not bad. Glass will be a problem. But all right, maybe glasses. You know the problem with glass? What's that? Well, it's not exactly liquid, is it?
It's a highly viscous liquid. If you have a window for 100 years, it's thicker on the bottom than on the top.
That's right. Glass flows from the top and flows with the force of gravity. Just very, very slowly. They took windows out of buildings that are 40, 50 years old, and they found that the windows are uniformly thicker at the bottom than they are at the top. Because the glass has flowed down from the top to the bottom.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
So they want to say that glass is a kind of fourth state of matter or something. Or it's a very viscous liquid, as he says. And so, but if you have solid, liquid, gas, and process, that pretty well covers everything, even the way we classify things. So then, those four are not elements out of which things are made, but they are states of matter. Okay. But from our point of view, none of that matters. What matters to us is, that's an expression for spiritual ideas. So similarly, when we borrowed, our ideas, actually this evidence that they borrowed from us, that's when there's a similarity between. That's the strike we borrowed. That's a mistake on my part. When there's a similarity between some of our structures and the structures of these other philosophies, one should not assume that the purposes are the same. And in the case of Neoplatonists, who described the existence of our world as emanations from God, and sometimes in the translations of our sources you have the word emanations that are used, so the academic says, oh, it says emanations here, it says emanations there. It's got to be the same thing, because he doesn't think about it for more than 30 seconds before he writes his paper. It doesn't have to be the same thing. It doesn't have the same purpose. It doesn't have the same meaning. Indeed, Ramchal, or one of his students, wrote an essay, a debate, between a Choker and a Mekubal. Choker is roughly a philosopher, and a Mekubal is a Kabbalist. And the philosopher accuses the Kabbalist of every conceivable heinous crime. How could you say that physical things come out of God? How could you say that things other than God are God? Aren't you a polytheist because there are lots of things you call God? What makes you any better than the Christians? I mean, it's all there. And the Ramchal answers all of the objections one by one. This essay is what got me started in working on Ramchal. I was reading this essay on an airplane. I remember it like yesterday. It was 20 years ago, 23 years ago. And in each paragraph I said, oh, but that's all fair. There's obvious objections to that. And the next paragraph he raised my objection. I felt he was reading my mind, even though it was written almost 300 years ago. But it was unbelievable. Every objection I thought of raising, the next paragraph he raised it and answered it. And I said, this is the man that I want to study. This is the man that I want to learn from. Anyway, so this idea of creation is something that's completely beyond us. Creation ex nihilo. If so, and if we take the idea that God is creator ex nihilo of the universe, so then it would be natural to infer that his nature is going to be beyond our ability to understand. But again, you're starting from the tradition's description of him as creating the universe out of nothing. If you didn't have that, you wouldn't be able to draw the conclusion. One more element, which I have mentioned to some of you in the past. If you take creation present tense, a creation is an ongoing process. Now here, it's important to note, this again comes from an essay from Abdur Ramchal, which is not translated, Ma'amar al-Chokhma. The Jewish view, it seems, according to, I believe everybody holds this way. Others think it's controversial, whether everybody holds this way. It's what it says in the Siddur. God is creating the universe moment by moment. He is doing it moment by moment. There's new creation moment by moment. It's important to understand that it didn't have to be that way. Ramchal says explicitly, it did not have to be that way. If God wanted to, he could have created something and given it its own ability to continue to exist independently. He just decided not to do it. And he explains why he decided not to do it. So that's what he chose to do. He chose to create the universe moment by moment. Now, the question then is, what am I? Who am I? I'm a thing that's being created moment by moment. Is my existence analogous to his existence? His existence is, so to speak, absolute, self-contained, necessary. My existence is contingent. I'm an artifact. So to some of you, I've used the analogy of a dream. If you're dreaming, and in your dream there are characters running around, walking and talking and doing things, what's the relationship between you and the characters in your dream? I think you could see that you're on different planes of existence. You know, you don't have, they don't have an existence equal to yours. Let's suppose in the dream, you're there too in the dream, which, as you know, often happens. And in the dream, somebody says, promise me you'll do X. And in the dream, you say to him, yes, I promise I'll do X. Now you wake up. Do you have to keep the promise? To whom did you make it? To that figment of your imagination? There's nobody on the other side. There's nobody there. Okay, now in a certain sense, we are figments of God's dream. So are we really there? Vis-a-vis God, we're not really there. For this reason, Maimonides goes so far as to say that when we can't describe God, we can't conceive God, we can't understand God, we can't even say that God exists. Because our concept of existence comes from our world. To say it exists will, again, require a comparison between him and the existence of things that we know. And in truth, there is no such comparison. Because all of our existence is the existence of an artifact. The existence of an effect. And his existence isn't like that at all.
Question. How does he have contact with, like, Nevi'im and stuff like that? Like, we're all, like, just part of a dream. He makes promises to them and he contacts them. And
so, you're right. I don't mean to make the analogy exact. If I made the analogy exact, then your question would be exactly right. I only mean it as the difference in level of existence. That his existence is independent, absolute, perfect, and our existence is dependent. Now, somehow, in creating us, he also gives us the ability to do something on our own. And then we exercise that ability on our own. But it's only there because he gives it to us. It's only there because he gives it to us. So, it's still true that we're an artifact, but we're the kind of artifact that has the ability to do something on its own. If you want a crude analogy, if you bust the nucleus of an atom and the particles scatter to and fro, the free neutrons, the neutrons that are outside the nucleus of an atom, don't last very long. They spontaneously disintegrate to proton, electron, neutrino, I think, or pion. No, neutrino. In some fraction of a second. Now, each one does it on its own. And the amount of time that it takes for each individual neutron to disintegrate is undetermined. Undetermined. There are no physical laws determining how long it will take for each neutron to disintegrate. This is a quantum process. It's based on the weak force. And it is essentially probabilistic. Some will take longer, some will take shorter. There's a certain average. The law of nature is the average, but what happens to each individual one is totally undetermined. So now, here are these neutrons sitting in the nucleus, and they're very stable. Nothing's happening to them. They're not breaking down. Now, I bust the nucleus. I have caused the neutrons to become isolated, and then they spontaneously disintegrate. So, let's see. Did I cause the disintegration? Sort of. That is to say, I caused the conditions under which they spontaneously disintegrate. But I didn't fully cause disintegration, because there is that probabilistic element, how long it'll take. And that's determined by the neutron itself. And nothing outside the neutron determines it. It's the weak force operating in the neutron. And it operates spontaneously. So, in a rough analogy, not perfect, but in a rough analogy, God creates us, gives us free will. He creates us and gives us free will, and then we operate with the free will. That's not so totally like our dream. The dream, when we dream something, the figment in our imagination doesn't have free will at all. So it's not exactly like a dream. But it is like a dream in this, that if I wake up, they're gone. And if God decides that he's had enough of this game, then we're gone. My existence depends totally on him. Only in giving me my existence, he also gives me that extra power, which is disanalogous to my dream.
So even with free will, if he decides that he had enough, it's all over.
As it is in death, when the person's free will stops. As it is in sleep, when a person's free will stops. As it was with Pharaoh, when God said, I've had enough of your free will. I don't want you to make free decisions, at least on three occasions. Yes, there are times when he says, I've had enough of that. I don't want that anymore.
Can you define what you mean by an artifact?
I think I can, but I should just pause to note that I don't owe definitions. Indeed, the demand for definitions has to be justified. And I will pause to explain this so as to have a ground rule that will be probably important as we go along. It is not always appropriate to ask for definitions of terms. Even though that's supposed to be the philosopher's battle cry. Define your terms. Because we all use terms, use them confidently, with agreements, and upon which we base very important decisions, terms that we cannot define. We are all doing that all the time. How about truth? There's no accepted method of defining truth. Indeed, there's considerable controversy about it in philosophy. Now, here's George. On the witness now. That's one of those prejudicial names. Peter. On the witness stand. I didn't mean to refer to the President of the United States. He's on the witness stand. And we say to him, Peter, you're under oath. Where were you on September 3rd? This is Chicago. Okay? In come two witnesses and they say, listen, Peter, on September 3rd, you were with us in Tunisia. So give up Chicago. Say to him, Peter, you lied under oath. That's perjury. You're going to swing for this and you're going to sit for this. Peter says, you're accusing me of lying under oath. I suppose that means I told an untruth. Right? Well, define your terms. Tell me what truth means. At which point, the professors from Harvard and UCLA and Princeton come in and say, can't do that, you know. I mean, I'm just writing a new book which proves everybody's wrong on this, and next year maybe you'll be able to do it. But right now you can't do it, but my book hasn't been published. Right? And then Peter says, well, you see, the world's experts can't define truth. So how can you accuse me of the crime of telling an untruth? Will that be an adequate defense? I don't think so. It's simply not correct. As one has to always define one's terms. Rather, the situation is like this. Any term, has some clear areas of application. Otherwise, it wouldn't be in the language at all. Otherwise, people wouldn't use it at all. Every term has some clear areas of application. Some terms, even some very important ones, have areas where it's unclear how to apply. That's why we look for definitions, because of the unclear areas. But if when you use the term, you are careful to stay within the clear area, then you don't owe anybody any definition. So when a person says to you, how do you define X? Your response should be, why do you think I need to define X? Where in my discussion did I use X in a gray area, in an unclear area, an area where the definition of X is crucial to make sure we are talking in a way that we're communicating? As long as you steer clear of the gray area, you have every right to use the term without a definition. Here's a simple example just to keep in mind. Where does a hill become a mountain? At what height? 4,652 feet, 5,701 feet. Where exactly does the hill become a mountain? I don't think there's an adequate answer to that question. You have things that are obviously hills, like what we have around here in Jerusalem. You have Everest, that's obviously a mountain. And then you have a gray area in between where it's just not clear whether the thing is a hill or a mountain. So, does that mean there's something wrong with my saying that around Jerusalem you have hills? I don't think so. Because the promontories in the area of Jerusalem are clearly on the hillside of the divide. There's nothing wrong with saying that Everest is a mountain, because Everest is clearly on the mountain side of the divide. Just stay out of the gray area. So the demand for an artifact, for a definition, is not always an appropriate demand. The person who makes the demand for a definition owes us some reason why we should try to define things. Now, but you ask for a definition of artifact, I don't think that one's too difficult. An artifact is something which was created by an intelligence that had a goal and saw this as a means to the goal, taking into account that means and goal might be the same. That's what I would describe as an artifact. I'll just insert here a little footnote, something that bothers me about contemporary thoughtless politics. The distinction between the natural and the artificial. It's close to what you're talking about. The natural and the artificial. Now, if you really are an ecologist, and you really believe in nature, what is the difference between an automobile, a beaver dam, and a beehive? We're just more animals, right? So beavers make dams, and bees make hives, and human animals make automobiles. I don't see any difference here at all. It's just more nature. There is no distinction. From the point of view of naturalistic ecology, there's no distinction between the natural and the artificial. The artificial is just human nature. Right? To celebrate unspoiled nature because you don't have skyscrapers there is nutty philosophically. The skyscraper is no different from the termite mountains. I mean, these termites make these 15, 20-foot mountains, right? Much bigger than our skyscrapers per size of creature. Right? That's considered part of untrammeled, unspoiled nature. And our hives that we erect out of concrete, that's somehow artificial. That's baloney, boys and girls. Right? Unless you think people are special, but they're not supposed to think that. Right? The answer I get when I talk to people like about in ecology about this is, we're going out and demonstrating for Greenpeace. Don't bother us with ideas. Which is about where it is. And maybe that's right. Why are ideas so important? Maybe Greenpeace is more important. But it's really, if you press the ideas, as I, as a philosopher, can't help doing. See, you do get some funny things about it. Here's another one. This is off on this tangent. You have an island. And on this island, there are two species that are nowhere else in the world. And one species is eliminating the other species. If you do nothing, species A is going to drive species B to extinct. What, for the sake of nature, should you do? On the one hand, there's going to be one less species. The richness, the diversity of nature is going to be reduced.
On the other hand, if you intervene, you're not letting nature take its course. Nature, as it's going, A, is extinguishing B. I ask this of people who are philosophically inclined and part of the ecological movement. Now I didn't have the answer, but they weren't interested in the question. Okay, that's where it is. Now back to work. So, God is beyond, utterly beyond our power to describe. So, what we are talking about with all the descriptions that they've given, as I've told you a number of times, is not what God is, but what God does. Let me introduce this idea with a couple of analogies. And then I'll try to describe it in some detail. Not what it is, but what it does. Let's take light. I'll warrant there aren't two of you who know what light is. What it is. What is light made of? This light. I mean, the light that's in this room now. The light comes out of the sun.
Particles.
Made of particles. But you know better than that. They're really wavicles, right? If they're particles, they're very strange particles. They do very, very strange things. If you don't know quantum mechanics, you haven't the foggiest idea what light is. And if you go back 100 years, nobody knew what light was. Well, okay, we've got to go a little further now. Planck is 1900. 105, 110 years. People knew that white light had certain wave properties. So they didn't know the right wave properties that make it important for mechanics. Newton thought the light was made of particles, but then Young's experiment with prisms showed that it's got to be waves, and nobody had a foggiest idea. And indeed, go back further, the theories about light are really wild. In ancient times, the going theory, the Greeks, was, how do you see? You see because your light, your eye, sends out a ray which hits the thing. And that's it's like your hand touching it. So your eye hits it with a ray. And that's how you see it. You'll ask me, if so, how come I can't see at night? Because the atmosphere becomes opaque to the ray. The light clarifies the atmosphere to allow the ray from your eye to hit the thing. And that's how you see. It has nothing to do with the light being reflected to your eye. It has nothing to do with it. Light doesn't have to come in. Your eye's going out. And this, by the way, is enshrined in our language. We talk about a person's piercing glance. What does that mean? His glance pierces, right? Because in language, that's the dead reference to that old theory. That when you look at something, you're sending out a ray. So, people had a great deal of experience what light does. They could create light. They could block light. Stronger lights. Weaker lights. Colors. They had a lot of experience with light. But they had the foggiest idea of what light is. We are very often in that situation where we know what a thing does, but we really have no idea what it is. Thomas Nagel, one of the contemporary philosophers who I think is really terrific, I learned a great deal from Thomas Nagel, gives the example of sound. Until about 200 years ago, did anybody have an idea what a sound is? I know that when you bang the bell over here, you hear it over there. I know that. And I know that if you close the doors to the room, it's harder to hear it outside. And indeed, when the guys are making a ruckus in the hall there, when we close the door, so it seems that sound is something that's blocked by physical barriers. Sound echoes. which is really a reflection of the sound off a surface. So sound can be reflected. The farther away you are, the fainter the sound is. So the sound certainly behaves like something physical. But what is it? He's banging over here, and I hear, and they hear it over there. What is it? What's? I don't see anything going by. I don't feel anything going by. And again, something's got to be going by. Otherwise, why would putting up a wall make it fainter? And nobody had a clue. Until it was discovered that it's sound waves, that it's air waves. And then you can check that. Try banging something in a vacuum and see what you get. You get nothing. But nobody had a clue what it was. That doesn't mean they were ignorant of what sound does. They know how to produce it. They know how to, what it means to respond to it. They just didn't know what it was. So if I say we don't know what God is, but we can describe what he does, I don't think that should be taken as a mystery. We're somehow on philosophically tricky ground. You know, we're somehow begging important questions here that we're escaping the, you know, escaping the real subject. I think we're in that situation quite often. Did anyone dream before the 20th century that this table is more than 99% empty space? Empty space? Did anyone dream that? Until Rutherford's experiments disclosing the structure of the atom, there's a tiny little nucleus in the center, and the electrons, which are only there when you look, are very far from the nucleus, and in between is empty space. Tell somebody the table is almost all empty space. They think you're nuts. Which means they really didn't know what the table is. Even though they know a lot about what it does. Because they don't know what it is. They don't know what it's made of. They don't know what makes it do what it does. That the strength of the table is based on electricity? Gosh, Doc, electricity. Why am I not getting a shock? That's because electricity is contained in atoms, and the atoms are electrically neutral. That's the positive charge is nucleus, and the electrons have a negative charge, and they're actually neutral. But the strength of it is on the basis of electrical charges. That's shocking. The stuff that goes in the sky with the lightning is what holds the table together. That's not obvious at all.
It says neutral, not shocking.
Understand? So it's quite literally true that until recently, no one had a foggiest idea what a table is. So we're in a similar situation vis-a-vis God. We're going to describe what God does. One last point on this. It's general orientation. We'll talk about it in much more detail next week. Now, when we talk about what the table does, we're pushing the language a little bit. The table does? The table doesn't do anything, right? I mean, it doesn't act. The table's not an agent. Things happen to the table. And in different conditions, different things happen. You can paint it, you can bang nails into it, you can burn it, you can break it, smooth it, dent it. That's not what it is doing. God acts. So when we describe what God does, we're not describing what happens. We're describing what he's doing. Describe what he's doing means that the elements of action will be part of the description. An action is the expression of a will. Or maybe in simple terms, a decision. And a decision, on the basis of an intelligent agent, a decision is undertaken for a purpose. So that when we describe what God does, it's not just this happened and God did it. That's true, but we're not limited to that level of description. We want to see this happened as a divine action, as a fulfillment of a divine will. And in describing that divine will, it will be crucial to describe the purpose of the will, and then how the particular action fulfilled that purpose. Which, again, I'm saying for a third time, could be that the will is that this particular thing happens. Purpose doesn't have to be external to what happens. Usually is, but doesn't have to be. This particular action might itself be its own purpose. But purpose has to be there. Doesn't have to be an external purpose, but a purpose has to be there. And one has to see how this particular action, this particular event, is related to that purpose. Only when you have that level of description, or that completeness of description, are you getting a description of a divine action. And that we are given. That's what we are given. We can picture, we can describe what happens as divine actions, together with the purpose of the action. And that becomes the crucial element in the description. If you know the purpose and you can see the purpose, you really have the essence of all we can expect to have in a particular description of what God does. If any of that is missing, then something's hidden and the situation is much more problematic.